and is anxious to get going. Get...
Entertaining motion to come out of recess back into public hearings.
Yes, you got it.
Motion, Mrs. Deaver.
Second.
Second, Mr. Arlett. Any questions on the motion? Take the vote, Mrs. Deaver.
Yes.
Cole. Yes.
Mr. Arlett.
Yes.
Yes, motion carried. We're now back into public session for our public hearing. Mr. Moore.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. It's now time for the opposition. It's my understanding that Mr. William Dunn is going to start the presentation. Mr. Dunn.
Good afternoon, President of Council and members of Council. My name is Bill Dunn. I'm a Delaware admitted attorney, and my bar number is 3342.
But you're admitting you're an attorney?
I am. But I'm heading out of town after I'm done. So.
I like that.
So I think I'm okay.
You might be.
Are we allowed to ask who you represent?
I represent the interest of individuals and families that are located around Old Landing Road. Not all of them, but okay. Some of them.
Thank you.
And if it pleases the council, I have a notebook that I would like to have admitted as part of the record. And I also have copies of the presentations that will be made for all council members, if I may approach.
Yes.
Please do. Rob needs something else to read.
We are very approachable, counselor.
Thank you.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
Just for the record.
So hopefully I can technically work all of this so that it works out right. We'll see how that goes. So as I indicated, I represent the interests of individuals and families who reside in the area of Old Landing Road and who will be among the most negatively affected by the change of zoning request pertaining to the parcel of land known as Old Landing Golf Course, filed by Osprey Point D, LLC, application CZ1759. My wife and I own a home in Sawgrass South, which is directly across Old Landing Road from the parcel in question. I'm an active member of the Delaware Bar, and my resume is attached for your information. But I caution that the organization for which I work is not involved in any way in this matter. I'm here in my personal capacity and serving my neighbors as counsel pro bono. We ask counsel to decline to recommend approval of the rezoning change at this time and allow more time for all issues to be fully developed. The submission of Osprey Point is incomplete. There are too many open issues for council to close the record at this time. Applicant has just submitted a new site plan, and we have not had the opportunity to review that new site plan. Let the record reflect that with respect, we expressly request council keep the record open. The developer's request for rezoning should be denied. However, should the council determine to allow petitioner to go forward under AR1 upzoning, the council, at a minimum, should strictly control density, preserve the character of the area, require adequate buffers, prevent flooding and adverse impacts on adjacent properties, minimize adverse environmental impacts, mitigate increased traffic, and provide community safety. In any event, any proposed plans or construction of Osprey Point should be subject to all requirements of the Code of Sussex County as amended, state and federal environmental laws, as well as all sediment and storm water management regulations and best practices. To accomplish this, we propose the council require restrictive covenants and disclosures in accordance with applicable law. To be clear, the residents I represent are not opposed to development per se if it's well planned. Neither are they unmindful of applicant's right to lawfully develop his property. That being said, we strongly object to the proposed zoning change. Our residents look to Planning and Zoning Commission and ultimately the Sussex County Council to protect this sensitive area by mandating a project designed with lower density, greater open space, appropriate stormwater management, consideration for environmental elements, and mitigation of traffic and safety concerns. The proposed subdivision presents a number of complex legal, environmental, and community impact issues. First, all development in Sussex County is subject to the Sussex County Comprehensive Plan Update and Future Land Use Plan, which has the force of law as provided in Sussex County Ordinance Number 1980. Second, the Comprehensive Plan Update and Future Land Use Plan designates growth areas, including environmentally sensitive developing areas. Sussex County Planning and Zoning Office has determined that based upon a review of the future land use map in the Sussex County Comprehensive Plan Update, the Old Landing Golf Course is located in the environmentally sensitive developing area, partially within an area designated mixed residential area. Third, this environmentally sensitive developing area is designated by the state as investment level 3 under the Delaware strategies and state policies for spending. This means Sussex County cannot expect the state to support development here with needed infrastructure spending in the near term. And it is expressly for that reason special scrutiny should be applied to spending decisions and development proposals within these areas to assure these activities are consistent with state and local development and preservation policies. Applicant's filing raises more issues than it resolves under the special scrutiny test with respect to flooding, wetlands, environmental problems, say nothing of safety concerns. One illustration is applicant's response to the document entitled Drainage and Flooding. These questions seek information concerning stormwater drainage. When weighed against the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control regulations now in effect, the inadequacy of their response is obvious. DENREC regulations require applicant to submit a stormwater assessment study that must be evaluated prior to submission of a detailed stormwater management plan. On information and belief, neither of those requirements has been met. The fact that the entire parcel is in a floodplain should caution against overdevelopment. Additionally, the parcel borders Arnell Creek, contains state and federal wetlands, and serves as an excellent groundwater recharge area. Under applicable law, the goal is to protect critical natural resources, such as inland bays, by guarding against overdevelopment and permanently preserving selected lands. The applicant has yet to provide complete information and documentation pertaining to various issues concerning the floodplain, wetlands, buffer requirements, and other essential requirements, including a summary of the proposed restrictive covenants, which provide for the perpetual maintenance of buffer areas and the maintenance of all streets, roadways, and other rights of way, a buffer around the entire perimeter. DENREC, Division of Fish and Wildlife, TAC review dated August 2014 recommended to leave intact a minimum of 100-foot buffer around the perimeter to protect the function and integrity of the wetlands on this parcel, a recommendation we still consider important. Recorded restrictive covenants must provide for maintenance of common areas, stormwater management areas, surface drainage facilities, erosion and sedimentation control facilities, and buffer areas. Applicant's proposal for rezoning and development plan fails a special scrutiny test because the preliminary plan must depict a forested and or landscape buffer in accordance with Sussex County Code 99-6J. The submission does not respond to the soils report dated September 8, 2014 that noted the prevalence of soils having features that are unfavorable for building site development because they are poorly drained or very poorly drained. For example, 35.7 acres of Falsington loam and areas of tidal marsh or swamp that will remain extremely wet all or most of the year. Applicant's response to the PLUS review leaves completely unanswered the strongly worded recommendation that applicants should avoid building in the Heidrick, Falsington, Broadkill, and Manahawkin soil mapping units. In addition, the Sussex County Assistant County Attorney states the site contains wetlands, but minimal use of wetlands and floodplains is an important consideration in the review process. Importantly, the PLUS review strongly recommended that a United States Army Corps of Engineers approved wetlands delineation study be conducted. Council should require an independent geotechnical report, which apparently was just turned in today, on the effects of building on hydric soils, which do not have adequate bearing capacities to support such construction. And the fact that that was just turned in today, if that's what that was, is another reason to continue to keep the record open for our purposes. The traffic load on Old Landing Road alone should raise a red flag with council. In the first place, my clients take strong exception to the Division of Planning's response to the service level evaluation request filed with the Planning and Zoning Commission in July 17 of 2014, wherein that office declined to require a traffic impact study for the application, notwithstanding that the proposed development meets our volume for requiring a traffic impact study. This departure from procedure premised on a 2011 traffic study of Old Landing Road is misplaced, and we still believe it's misplaced. The 2011 traffic study does not take into account the construction of many additional homes and townhomes in Sawgrass South, The homes now being built in Shell and Sawgrass North, 80-plus homes in Redden Ridge, 32 homes in the woods of Arnell Creek, and the additional townhomes in Sterling Crossing. Additional presentations will provide Council with greater detail with regard to our concerns. Leslie Lettegar will provide our environmental concerns. George Barstar will provide information on our flooding concerns. Rich Morgante will provide our concerns regarding adjacent communities. And Donna Voigt will provide Council with information on our traffic concerns. In closing, while the applicant has the right to develop his property, current and future residents have a right to a well-planned and safe community. Therefore, we ask County Council to protect this sensitive area by mandating a project designed with lower density, greater open space, appropriate stormwater management, consideration for environmental elements, and mitigation of traffic and safety concerns. In short, we respectfully ask Council to seriously consider our concerns and keep the land AR1 zoning, have the applicant resubmit an AR1 zoning plan with lower density, no building on environmentally sensitive areas and hydric soils, larger buffers to protect inland bays, and to mitigate increased traffic and provide for community safety. In essence, this is our environment, our home, and our future, and we're asking County Council to please protect it. And at this time, I would ask Leslie Lettegar to come forward and provide Council with our concerns regarding and the environmental concerns.
Okay. Did you sign in as well?
I did not.
Okay. I'd ask anyone that speaks today, please sign in.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
Members of Council, good afternoon. My name is Leslie Lettegar, and it is a distinct pleasure to appear before you here today. In the interest of full disclosure to the tribunal, I also am an attorney, and I do admit so. However, I am not licensed in the state of Delaware. I do, however, bring 25 years of experience in the environmental arena to bear on this project. So when my friends and neighbors that are in this audience right here today, and we're all your neighbors as well, ask me to make some comments based on that extensive experience, my answer was, yes, I'll be happy to. My experience, first of all, is 8 years as a consulting forester and as a former landowner. I owned 107 acres of prime timberland in the Deep South. I understand farming. I understand the land and how we must be good to the land if it is to be good to us. I also bring to you 15 years of experience as an environmental attorney, the last 10 of which were with a sister state's Department of Environmental Protection. As a former regulator, I have to say that this property and this project bring up at least 5 red flags that I would like to discuss with you today. The first red flag.
Leslie, I apologize. May I real quick?
Sir.
I just wanted to, again, I'm a guy, so I need a visual. I know Mr. Dunn is a neighbor. I think you shared that, correct, that you live in the surrounding area. Do you also own a home in the surrounding area?
Thank you for reminding me, and I'm sorry that I didn't abide by Mr. Moore's direction to state my address. I am a resident of the Retreat of Love Creek, which is in Lewis, at the intersection of Cedar Grove and Robinsonville Roads. My full address is 38415 Arnell Drive.
Okay.
Thank you
Great.
For reminding you. Me of that, sir.
Thank you.
My first concern is that the proposed plan, as I read the Sussex County plan, contravenes the plan for developing in environmentally sensitive districts and also for the requirements of superior design. Secondly, the development is improperly proposed in a flood zone. Third of all, the development is improperly proposed on hydric soil. Fourth, a wetlands mitigation plan may actually be required for this site. And stormwater control planning is insufficient to protect neighbor drinking water wells in the area. Now, I will say at the outset that I personally am not opposed to development on this property. And in fact, I agree with applicant's attorney that consideration of this plan is obviously not a popularity contest, as he characterized it, and as I'm sure you all know. Rather, the discussion must be based in law. And as opposition's counsel eloquently pointed out, and we completely agree, all development in Sussex County is indeed subject to the Sussex County Comprehensive Plan and the Future Land Use Plan. And these requirements are, in fact, mandatory because of Ordinance 1980. The Comprehensive Plan, once adopted, is to have the force of law. The challenge, and this is what we would like to assert, the challenge is not whether we're pretty and they are not, whether we're popular and they are not. Rather, it is a rational evaluation based on what it is we have to balance. We all know that the area to propose to be developed is in an area that is prime for residential development, but it also contains beautiful, pristine, or not pristine, but beautiful environmental areas. So the key here, and I would challenge you, as the plan challenges you, is to balance safeguarding genuine natural areas and the concept of mitigating roadway congestion with the tourism and real estate markets that drive the economy of this area. Now, the plan, although it does have the force of law, does have some flexibility in it. The comprehensive plan, in fact, allows investment level three areas, and you've already heard what those are, to allow development as part of a county's future growth zone. However, there's a caveat. When is that allowed? Proposals must be evaluated with special scrutiny, and that special scrutiny lies in your hands. That's where your discretion comes in. And it must be consistent with state and local development and preservation policies. This plan, as it is currently proposed, doesn't mean that it can't be redone to actually do this, but as it's currently proposed, it doesn't do that. It removes all the trees. There are very few mature lobs out there, but they're going to be gone. And it also proposes to build on hydric soils and much too close to critical wetlands, notwithstanding the fact that the plan has been remodified to take out a mere 10 lots and to put in additional buffers. The comprehensive plan allows the accommodation of development. We get that. We absolutely get that. But when does it allow it? It allows it if special environmental concerns are addressed. Does this plan do that? In our humble opinion, the answer is no. It does not adequately address flooding, stormwater management, or wellhead protection and wetland protection issues. Third, the plan allows two homes per acre, right? There is an option to go to four units per acre if the developer uses optional density bonuses. Does this plan do that? No. It exceeds four units per acre on information and belief. Now, again, I have not evaluated this based on the new plan, so obviously I caveat my comments on that. But in my opinion, in the prior plan, the answer is no. The fourth thing that the comprehensive plan does contemplate is smaller lots and flexibility in dimensional standards, and it says those should be allowed. If, the question is when, if the developer uses cluster options resulting in permanent preservation of substantial portions of the tract. This plan, as you can see for yourself from developers' boards, whiteboards, shows that lots are evenly spaced across the tract, and we'll get more into that in just a second. Additionally, the comprehensive plan, which we've already established, has the force of law at pages 330 through 332, require superior design in these sorts of areas. Superior design requirements that on information and belief I don't find in the plan are that homes are not clustered on the most suitable portions of the site. And in fact, when you're doing a plan like this, you're supposed to identify the most suitable portions of the site before you lay out the lots, not after. In addition, you are supposed to direct a building away from wetlands, waterways, and other important natural features. I don't see this plan doing that to the greatest extent that it needs to. There is some delineation of wetlands, I agree, but not enough. Third, we are not preserving thick natural vegetation along creeks. And we all know, as residents of this county, how important the preservation of wetland buffers and vegetation along creeks are, because that actually serves as a sponge, as a buffer, to help prevent nutrients from entering the waterways, entering the bays, and polluting the bays even further. Fourth, homes are to be placed on tract portions that are most environmentally suitable for development. So we're not just saying, oh, can I engineer this? Is it possible? That's not the consideration. The consideration, is it environmentally suitable? Poor and natural drainage areas should be located early in the design process, and I maintain to you, I do not believe they have been. This community design, now we're going to flip to the county code, sections 115 through 118. The applicant claims that Osprey is not a cookie-cutter design. And, I mean, I acknowledge and I applaud their efforts to cut out some lots in certain places. But I will say, as you can tell from their pictures, and their pictures speak 1,000 words, the lots are uniformly developed. There's very little variation in type and style. They meet only minimum standards without consideration of environmental or historical features. And there's no design ingenuity, in our opinion. They have simply been designed to meet minimally acceptable regulations. Now, as a business person, I get that. I want to maximize my investment for my dollar. But as the thing that's right to do and what is required by the law, that's an entirely different issue. Let's stick with the law. Now, you've heard a lot about comparison of this property with Sawgrass. And again, I do not live in Sawgrass, but I have many friends who do. And I will say that Sawgrass does, in fact, border wetlands, has mixed lot sizes and home styles. There are large state wetland buffers. There are borders on Old Landing Road and in the interior. They have nitrogen reductions of 72.7% and 40.7% of phosphorus, which is stellar. And in fact, they have been given kudos and applause and awards from state and county for the design, for their great sensitivity in preserving the environment and most of the wooded areas. Now, and the comments about Osprey were put in place on this slide before the new development or the new design was come up, but I will say that, and I applaud them for meeting the nitrogen and phosphorus reduction requirements. However, it's simply not enough. When you talk about the layout, permission to approach?
Certainly.
When you talk about the layout, I think you will see there's absolutely no comparison between the layout of Sawgrass and the layout of this property. The layout of Sawgrass has buildings that are clustered in away from environmentally sensitive areas. And we do acknowledge that some of the townhomes are located near Old Landing Road. However, the majority of them are actually located towards the back of the development in such a way that it makes it visually and design criteria a superior design. Speaking of superior design, clustering homes on the most suitable portions of the site is a requirement. That is a criteria. Osprey inaccurately stated that there are no archaeological sites on this parcel, and that is on information and belief. They have presented data to you today, to which I am not privileged, to the extent that you find that their data is more accurate than this, that's fine. However, we have gone to the archaeological office, and we have found that there is actually an archaeological site out there. So we can provide additional information on that to the extent you
need. Could you point that out where? On the community map? I mean, where in the community? Out of curiosity, is that possible?
Permission to consult.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think we're talking about this, and I figure let's show where it is. If you're later, okay.
We have someone.
Sorry for jumping the gun.
We have someone that can inform you on that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. It is also our opinion that applicants seeks density over preservation. If you look at Sawgrass, you'll see that the homes are clustered away from the environmental areas, whereas this one is clearly spread out across the entire site. And lastly, Denrec's soil scientists, notwithstanding the erudite presentation from applicant's expert, Denrec's soil scientists strongly recommend against building on all hydric soils. And those are the Falsington, the Manahawkin, and the Broadkill soils. And in spite of that, you will find out in just one second exactly how this is violated in their plan. The second environmental concern is flooding. Now, this is a FEMA map. We're not making this up. This is from FEMA. This is the Sussex County Information Flood Information Portal, FEMA flood map. 58% of the golf course lies in a floodplain. Now, I understand that applicant thinks they're going to make this all better. However, the fact that one is in a FEMA floodplain is significant. This is a federal government mapping unit that has been recently proposed based on the latest soil science and the latest hydrologic science and the latest climate data. You do not ignore this, okay? The property is designated as Zone AE. Let me short end this for you. Bottom line this for you is what I'm trying to say. The residents here will be required to get mandatory flood insurance. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And in fact, the current owner actually, on information and belief, uses a pumping system to drain the golf course of stormwater to render it playable after storm events. FEMA does not prohibit building in a floodplain. We acknowledge that. However, they recommend avoidance, and that's what I'm asking you to do today. I'm not asking you to say, oh, you can't build on this property at all. What I'm asking you is to avoid and not be stupid, okay? Why would we, as does the federal government, building outside of high-risk storm areas and build on and or build to flood-resistant standards using the resources that are listed on their website. And, in fact, you can click on any one of these, and the sources right down the bottom. So if you want to know what those standards are, click there. Sussex County also has certain requirements in place for building in wetlands and floodplains. And again, the idea is to avoid. Council is legally obligated to consider the minimal use of wetlands and floodplains under Sussex County Code Section 99-9C2. 99-9C10 requires council to ensure the minimization of, again, avoidance, minimization. Those are the key things, and these are in the code. erosion and sedimentation, changes in groundwater levels, increased rates of runoff, and potential for flooding. And this part of the code, 99-9C10, requires that the design of drainage, the drainage must be designed so that groundwater recharge is maximized, not minimized. That's the only place where we want to maximize, is getting that groundwater to be recharged. In my opinion, Osprey Plan fails to deal with the flood hazards. It is not coincidental. In fact, it is scientifically supportable that the lines of the flood-prone areas, which you can see on the left-hand map in the blue shaded area, are almost analogous and line up almost exactly with the location of the hydric soils on this property. In other words, the soils that are in red should be avoided. Building on the upland areas, which are in green, is fine. Building on the red areas should be avoided.
May I ask a quick question, if I could, Mr. President? That picture to the right shows basically the area in the red is drainage is a challenge, correct?
Yes.
Okay. The map over here in light blue, if I recall from the earlier presentation, shows the same. Or it was stated that it's the same. That I'm seeing two different areas, or am I wrong? Maybe I'm not. I guess the blue and the red, Maybe because there's different shades of blue over here. Is that what it is?
It is. There are different shades of blue. And in fact, soils map is based on the map that was provided by the county. This is a county soils map. I do not know the source of that map, so I cannot speak to that map. You're correct to compare, and I would invite you all to make that comparison and find out exactly where that comes from. Because this map that I have on my slide, and yes, we also have an engineer that will be able to help with the answer to your question as to the location of the hydric soils. My map shows all of the soils, all of the hydric soils, not just the Falsington. Okay?
We're paying attention, that's all. Paying attention.
And these are the sort of scientific comparisons that we really invite and welcome you to make. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Which moves us to the hydric soils and wetlands issues. As you all know, the Federal Clean Water Act does have some extensive verbiage about what are wetlands. And that language was put in there because at the time, wetlands were being filled willy-nilly, and the benefits of those wetlands were being lost at an alarming rate. So Section 404 of the Clean Water Act defines wetlands as areas that are inundated or saturated by surface or groundwater at a frequency and duration sufficient to support a prevalence of vegetation, and under normal circumstances do support the prevalence of vegetation, typically adapted for life in saturated soil conditions, generally includes swamps, marshes, bogs. We're all used to that. The thing that I would caution you about this property is that one of the indicators of wetlands, and I acknowledge that ERI has apparently done a preliminary delineation. I would urge you to ask them to do a site-specific on-the-ground delineation to the extent they have not, because hydric soils are an indicator of wetlands. And I have to tell you that their map, applicant's map, does delineate some wetlands, but I would posit perhaps not all. Some wetlands are not easily recognized. They may be dry during a part of the year. They may just not look wet. They don't look familiar, and we ignore them. That's not appropriate. Only an on-the-ground wetlands delineation will solve that issue. You've already seen this map, and I've already said to you, it's not a coincidence that the areas that flood correspond almost exactly with the areas that are hydric. Hydric means full of water, basically. We understand that the applicant has obtained a preliminary jurisdictional determination letter from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. A JD is a term of art, and it is something that if the applicant chooses not to contest, that means they have accepted what the Army Corps of Engineers has stated. I think they have done that, and that's fine. Building on hydric soils, however, should be prohibited, and this is not just me saying this. This is the future land use plan at page 3-16. No field mapping has actually been done. Well, this may not be true because they indicated today that some field mapping has been done on the ground. I would ask you to be persuaded to require additional mapping because, as I said, hydric soils are an indicator of the presence of wetlands. To the extent that hydric soils are present, and let me just go back a second. If you look at their site plan, you will see that they're proposing to put a bunch of ponds in up at the northern part of the site. And this map is oriented north to south. To the extent that any of those ponds are wetlands and they propose to dredge them, they propose to fill them, they propose to disturb them in any way, they are disturbing wetlands. Under the 2008 Memorandum of Agreement with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, under Section 404, wetlands mitigation may indeed be required. And this is the question that I would ask. I don't believe we're putting the cart before the horse at this point. I understand we're at the preliminary phase, but we're all intelligent people, and we want to ask intelligent questions before we approve a land use application of this magnitude. And again, my mantra, avoid. The feds say avoid. Do not disturb in wetlands. Before a permit will be issued, if you cannot avoid the wetlands, which they recognize that flexibility, you have to minimize the impacts if the impacts cannot be avoided. And there are ways to compensate under 40 CFR, that's Code of Federal Regulations, Section 230.93. You have three options. Permittee responsible mitigation, that is providing a tract of land that on which one can build wetlands to replace the wetlands that have been disturbed, dredged, otherwise denuded. You can do mitigation banking, or you could put up some money. I haven't heard how their plan plans to do that at all, or whether they have even addressed why their plan does not require wetlands mitigation. Serious question. My last concern is that the project should be subject to the stormwater planning is insufficient. And I think one of you asked, I think it was you, Councilman Cole, about the stormwater regulations that were effective January 1st. I acknowledge, and my friends do as well, that the Osprey Points Plan is grandfathered under Section 3.5.6 of the revised Delaware Sediment and Stormwater Regulations. However, I would say to you that it is unlikely that this project, given its size and the questions that we all have, is likely to gain approval before the mandated July 1, 2015 deadline. And that deadline is set in the code. That's the 18 months from the effective date of the revised regulations. Those regulations were revised effective January 1, 2014. So that's where the 18 months come in. If final approval is not secured, and that's final approval, within 18 months, the project will be subject to the new regulations. Somebody asked or brought up a point about the case that turned down the 100-foot buffers and that sort of thing. And I'm a little bit out of order here, but I wanted to bring that up. As a former regulator, I understand what happened there. DENREC proposed to regulate according to guidance. They attached a document to the back of their regulations that said, okay, we're going to regulate according to this document that we've attached to the back of the code. That is not permissible under the Administrative Procedure Act because it is not given the force of law. It's not in the code. That being said, administrative law dictates that the reason you have an administrative agency is because that agency has special knowledge. Okay? So part of the Department of Environmental Protection, where I worked, we were there to inform the legislature. We had scientists, engineers, lawyers, hydrogeologists, all manner of experts upon which the governor and the legislature could call, just as you do here. And that special expertise has been given deference under the courts, from the Supreme Court case in Chevron all the way down. So to the extent that DENREC or DLDOT or someone else gives you a recommendation, it's not based on the air. It's based on their special expertise. So I just wanted to put that plug in for regulators. Plan under the stormwater plan here, and I'm going to defer to our expert, George, on this. But I do not believe that the plan adheres to the PLUS recommendations, and again, PLUS is your regulators, to include the calculation of all forms of post-construction surface imperviousness, whether created or constructed. And this imperviousness should be taken out of the calculation before you calculate whether the property can actually absorb the stormwater. And in another of my colleagues is going to show you some pictures that, again, are worth 1,000 words as to why that flooding issue is hugely important. We don't yet know what types of basins will be proposed on this property. We're very early in the process. I get that. But I will say, and as their expert has pointed out, you've got groundwater that is anywhere from 2 to 5 feet below ground level. So if you're going to build a stormwater retention basin that does not intersect that groundwater, it's going to have to look like a saucer. Because if you dig one that looks like a bowl, you're going to intersect that groundwater, okay? If you dig a deep retention basin and it looks like a bowl and it intercepts that groundwater, what's going to happen? That groundwater is going to flow right into that detention basin. Where's the stormwater going to go? It ain't. If you dig a lined basin, that is, you have a stormwater retention basin with a liner, HDPB, whatever it is they put in nowadays, it is unlikely that the liner in these hydric soils, not all over the property, but in the hydric soils, will be able to withhold that hydrostatic pressure, keep it back. So the groundwater is going to be pushing in on those walls, your liner is going to float. Whether that is an engineering consideration that can be ameliorated, I don't know. I defer to the engineers. But I've seen it happen on prior experience, and I can only bring that to you as something to consider. Additionally, the stormwater, because your groundwater is so close to the surface here, the stormwater retention basins are likely to serve as a direct conduit to groundwater. In other words, when you get that stormwater running into those retention basins, that's going to carry the nitrogen and phosphorus that we talked about before from the lawns and everything else. It's also going to carry MTBE and other pollutants from the cars that are on the roadways. It's going to cover, it's going to carry pollutants from the macadam. These are all pollutants that are in surface water and flow into groundwater, okay? Because your groundwater table is so close to the surface, those pollutants will get into the groundwater, all right? Now, the importance of this is that, and without getting too technical here, when you have a well, a drinking water well or an irrigation well, that well exerts pressure. It creates a cone, and it draws groundwater into itself, all right? With it, it's not just the water that goes into that well. It's all of the nutrients and the contaminants and everything else from around the property. The reason I bring this up is because my friends and neighbors in Old Landing Woods are on well water. They derive their potable water from wells. Now, before you say, oh, let's just install public water, that has never been a solution. My background is in the cleanup of contaminated sites, all right? And many times the polluter would say, oh, don't worry about it. I will provide drinking water by virtue of hooking up to the public water system. Can I tell you what a burden that is on landowners? First of all, you have to install those lines. Who's going to pay for that? Second of all, you have to install the hookup to the main lines from each house. Who's going to pay for that? And then, in the end, to the extent you were able to put all that infrastructure in place, the individual homeowner is now socked with a water bill. However high or low it is, it's another bill that they really didn't have before. So we can prevent that from happening. Okay? That's why I'm bringing this up. I just wanted to see if there was anything else. As I said, I'm not a Delaware licensed attorney, and I have not had the chance to read Gibson versus Sussex County or Brockstead versus Sussex County. I will rely on counsel for applicant, however, when he posited that these are cases upon which one should rely, because they make total sense to me. One should not give a landowner disparate treatment, nor should this council cherry pick particular proposals to approve or deny. And we are not asking you to do that. We are asking you to, as these cases require, use the rational basis. There's flexibility in the plan. The plan is law, but there is flexibility there. Let's be smart. I told you my five concerns at the very beginning, and there they are again. In short, this proposed rezoning should not occur as it's current, and this design should not occur as it's currently formulated. We're not saying no to development. We're saying smart development, because in the end, we're all neighbors. In the end, it's our environment. It's our home. It's our future. Thank you so much for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And were you going to introduce the next speaker?
Yes. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is George Barrister with GEI Consultants.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And before he comes up, I just wanted to present, and I forgot to do this, there's an excellent article on the impact of storms, and it's a report that was done by the Army Corps of Engineers, and it appeared in the Daily News Journal. And I just thought it was really informative that flooding is a true issue. It's not just us saying it. Permission to approach?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, my name is George Barrister. I'm a consulting engineer with GEI Consultants, Incorporated. My office address is 18,000 Horizon Way, Mount Laurel, New Jersey. I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Delaware. I have about 30 years' experience, bachelor's and master's in civil engineering. My undergrad emphasis was environmental. My master's emphasis was geotechnical. I'm also a certified professional in erosion and sedimentation control.
What is that? How do you spell your last name? Just for my own purpose here.
Beg your pardon?
Your last name. Spell
it. Barstar, Barstar.
Thank you.
And what I'd like to do is basically spend a little time talking about how the existing zoning probably allows for the maximum amount of development that's already capable for the site. I go through some of the rationale for why changing zoning is not necessary, and then also why this particular proposal has some flaws in it that need to be addressed, especially with respect to environmental concerns, and then provide my conclusions and recommendations accordingly. Okay, so as we've been through the existing site, you're all familiar with, one thing I did want to get emphasis is we do have a couple overlays, including the environmental sensitive development district and the floodplain district overlay. While the application is a little bit moving target, it's already been presented pretty well as going over it, but I just want to talk about the existing zoning. Right now, there's an allowable use for the golf course, but it's also possible to develop this site with a combination of cluster housing and a residential subdivision with no change in zoning at all. In fact, we'll get into it a little bit later, but probably the best solution for developing this site is going to be primarily cluster development in those isolated areas that are most subject to preferable siting. And there's no problem meeting that with this site, in that, you know, the minimum track size is going to be well in excess of the 10-acre minimum. I'm looking, my rough estimate is probably about 55 of the 125 acres, or 43%, just what they're originally proposing now meets that criteria. So we're well into use a cluster zone with the existing zoning setup. One of the things I looked at was basically, as we've been through it, you've heard about the idea of isolating the site from the hydric soils, and essentially almost flipping the idea of the development area of the soil from about a project of about 80 acres developable down to about a little under 60 acres of development, and looking at if we take out the hydric soils and the wetland, additional wetland buffer, we're about 74 acres. And again, consistent with that, they've already proposed about 30% of additional land for stormwater management and the roads, right-of-way easements. The additional open area that they have proposed, the active open space for the clubhouse, gives us about 46 acres or so. And with the 4 per acre lot size, you're looking at 202 units possible. But if you go with the cluster housing, you're up to 264 by ordinance, and looking at approximately, with 7,500 square foot rationale, you're looking at 269. So about, you could probably build a cluster housing of about 264 units with the existing zoning in place. Alternatively, if we go with the 20,000 foot assumption, you're down to around 100 units or so for a large development of single family homes on those. But the site is developable for this, this really without even addressing the zoning change. Now, one of the things I wanted to look at when you're doing the subdivisions, regardless of the zoning, we want to look at whether suitable. And the whole issue is whether we got improper drainage and flooding or those other adverse formations. And this site, really kind of looking at the environmental special scrutiny, kind of really falls under that category. So, and as the site is presently developed, I don't think they've really adequately addressed those site constraints. Yeah, and they've already been kind of going through with flooding, drainage management, wetland impacts. And there's several others that were identified in the plus review that we're probably not going to go into, but they're there in the record. So the application, again, we have about 50 acres or so of passive open space. But again, that is really not sufficient to address the entire site. I'm sorry. Yeah, first one I want to look at is the wetlands, and we've already discussed this, and we talked about the code and how core and the plus study recommended that the DENRAC and the Corps come out together to look at the site. Now, that hasn't been done, and that really kind of needs to be established, especially coordinated with the hydric soils. I realize Mr. Hines has already been out there and done some of that preliminary work, but I think as the development proceeds, that full delineation needs to really properly be honed down. And again, I believe that some of that work has already been done. And we talked about the 20-foot step to the 25-foot existing setback and the recommendation for the 100-foot setback. And I'm aware of the case law involved in that. And if we take that out, you will be really bringing out a lot of the a lot of sites as presently proposed. But that 100-foot setback of this particular site corresponds to some of the other constraints that we're very concerned about. And that basically is the hydric soils. Again, we've talked about hydric soils a little bit throughout all this, but I think the thing that is really key to remember is that, as PLUS Review said, hydric soils act as nature's sponge by retaining water. And while some of the constraints of and problems with hydric soils that have been addressed by the geotechnical investigation be ameliorated, I mean, I understand that some of the hydric soils that were built on in Sawgrass they've had some issues with mold and water in the housing and that kind of thing. And those things can be addressed by engineering controls. And whether or not you're going to have to end up having deep foundation elements, it sounded like from what Mr. Hines says, there's suitable sands underneath there that if they had to go to the deeper foundation, you could develop that. Whether how economically feasible that is another issue, but it could be done. The big key here is really following in whether if this site is really going to be subject to the new stormwater regulations and how that impacts the whole drainage of the site and how we're going to rely on the hydric soils to mimic the natural water flow. So again, if you end up, we've seen this map a few times. Just walk over here with the, where is the microphone? Thank you. Walk over to the screen here and just pointing out that, again, the red areas are those areas that were mapped to hydric soils, and they generally correspond with the areas in blue that Mr. Hines has shown on his presentation. In addition, there's this area that's yellow, which is the Piney Neck, that may also fall into that not-so-well-drained area, so it may be excluded. So when I'm looking at developing this parcel, the idea of having this area up here as probably suitable for single-family housing, and then cluster development here in the center area along Old Landing Road, and then additional development on this portion of the property seems to be making the most sense for that environmentally sensitive cluster development. And I did want to also say that my review of this site with definition of the hydric soils, I also turn this off. Looked at the original mapping that was done in, or prior mapping that was done in 1971 for the published old hardback bound soil conservation district soil surveys, and compared that with the present mapping that's available on the website from the Soil Conservation Service. And they generally correspond, but you can see that there was some adjustment in some of the areas defined in hydric soils on the lower half of the site. The southern portion of the site, being that the older mapping only showed the first nine holes of the golf course being developed. So I tend to believe, one of the first things I do when I look at this map is say, how real is it and does it make sense? And it does seem to be corresponding to what's actually out there, though I have recommended that it be further refined. And to some extent, it seems like the applicant has already done that. But with respect to, it's not just, again, the engineering controls. It's also how they're going to function with the stormwater requirements if, in fact, the new stormwater management regulations apply. Right? I'll walk over to that plan. On the left side, looking at the graphic provided by the applicant. On the north side, you can see that there's these well-drained soils to the northeast. These poorly drained soils to the northeast of the site. And it appears to me, just looking at this map, that there's a great natural drainage pattern coming through here, coming across the site, and heading into this wetland. And one of the things with the new stormwater management regulations is that you're supposed to mimic the existing natural flow and existing natural hydrologic contour properties, so that this flow should still be able to have that damped, as we said, talk about the hydric soils being that nature's natural sponge. Those areas should be able to mimic that with controlling the run-on here, and also in this low portion in the center of the site. Yeah. Because of where we are in the world, this is the outfall of Arnell Creek into the bay. And you're basically dealing with not just a upland site where you're looking at stormwater management going into a drainage ditch or a small creek, but this area does have those, is a natural receptor and part of the whole estuary of the of Rehoboth Bay. And that's something, part of that environmentally sensitive district special scrutiny that you need to look, I recommend that you look at as part of considering whether or not this application makes enough sense to go forward in its current form. And again, one of the big things, of course, really the crux of this application, in my mind, is whether or not the stormwater, the new stormwater management regulations apply. My understanding, there's basically three legs of the stormwater management regulations, the TMDL, the nutrient that we talked about, the traditional stormwater management of controlling peak flow, but there's also, under the new regulations as well, control of the total amount of water generated through the one-year design storm and how that should be handled on-site through infiltration capacity or other means, other best management practices, to control flow prior to leaving the site. And this application doesn't address that, and in its present form, it's my opinion that it can't address that. The development, again, my understanding is that there was a meeting with the Conservation District prior to the 1st of January 2014, and so that's grandfathered to that extent. But it's also my understanding, and frankly, you're best talking to the Conservation District yourselves, but my understanding is where this application is and with the current pipeline and staffing that they have within the Conservation District, this plan is not going to be able to be approved in its final form by the deadline. And again, that's my understanding based on a conversation someone else had. I strongly urge the council to determine on its own whether or not that is in fact the case, because that really will impact whether or not this is approvable. And again, the thing that I'm really relying on with my comment is how the stormwater management is supposed to reduce runoff, mimic the natural watershed hydraulic policies, cause no inverse impact to the property. And you know, there's that three-step process. Well, they've already kind of had the equivalent of that, the first step, at least. There's two final steps that probably I don't know whether they may end up being combined or how the process is going to go on, but there's still a lot of work that has to be done and reviewed by the Conservation District prior to the final determination. Under the new regulations, basically before it even reaches the council here, they would have had that project application meeting and done that first step. And I've kind of gone through some of those steps, portions of the first step in an exercise I just want to share with you. Again, that it's a pre-application meaning you do the stormwater assessment study or report, and DEDREC provides a form that you fill out, and those form has seven objects on it. It also has identification of whether or not you're going to have any mitigation plan and have that kind of all set up up front, at least the topic of discussion, so for planning purposes and initial whether or not you think it's going to be feasible. So basically the whole idea is whether the project is going to be feasible and whether or not you're going to need mitigation being conducted, and then their information gets forwarded to you. So we looked at kind of doing a quick and dirty review of those report of the application to see whether or not there's those sufficient red flags. With respect to the soils, which is the first one of those, we have a lot of those items bringing up the red flags. We have hydric soils in excess of 50 feet. We've got soils identified as very limited for excavated ponds through the high water table, as especially as Mr. Hines said, within the areas of the hydric soils.
50 acres?
Yeah, the hydric soils constitute over 50 acres of the site. So that's kind of, that's the crux of whether or not you're going to have this large amount of open area or be able to have the more exhaustive development that is presently contemplated. So again, basically you go through this list and there's all these flags come up. Second, we look at the runoff potential. I will say that between the meeting with the Planning Commission and at this point, it sounds like a lot of the tree protection has been added. So that was a significant issue, but I think it's been somewhat addressed. But we still may be able to qualify for they still may end up with a significant rating for that particular. So then we get to water resource protection. I'm going to discuss this a little bit more detail shortly, but whether or not the site conditions adversely affect runoff reduction or pollutant loading conditions. I've let the pollutant loading conditions, I think, are really kind of addressed by the fact that you now have, you're changing the golf course to this limited use residential area, so you're actually improving it even before you start. However, the idea of the runoff protection event and how that falls into the regulations is really the critical thing. Whether or not you're going to be able to have sufficient capacity to handle infiltration or other best management practices to address that amount of water that's going to be gained from the additional impervious area. As I said before, traditional stormwater management, peak flow post-development is less than peak flow pre-development, but now we also have to have no net impact of total amount of water coming off of the site under the new regulations and how that impacts based on based on what you have as far as infiltration capacity or other credits that you get from different best management practices. We also have discharge points to look at as part of that checklist. And that's, again, something that's really important for this particular site because of the fact that you're looking at discharging at the end of Arnell Creek as it discharges into the bay. And so you have basically you have backwater conditions associated with that, and you're looking at the impacts of how that's going to impact the flow of Arnell Creek at its outlet. Again, we want to talk about water resource protection. There is DENREC does provide on its website a urban runoff management model that I ran a couple.
Sorry. Wait, okay, something's happened. Her computer came alive.
Sorry. Lord.
Thought you got that.
David Gaffney won't leave me alone. Oh, Lord.
Thank you, George. It's a public
podcast.
Yeah. This isn't that veterinarian thing again. The county council
County. They're talking about county council on the radio.
Those
buggers. Where's the radio thing?
I'm looking for it. That's a podcast.
Veterinarian.
Robin, you can please turn it off for us.
Yeah.
We obviously find you down. We're going to have a little class on how to operate
that.
Jonah's been streaming live.
Uh oh.
Sorry.
Technology is my bane as well.
Never a dull moment.
This is the best entertainment in Sussex County. I'm telling you. Every Tuesday, and it's free.
She can't get rid of it.
Throw it out the window.
As you were.
Thank you.
Where were we?
Yeah.
We were talking about whether or not how the site would be addressing that additional 99% probability storm or one year storm with respect to infiltration capacity. And I was saying that DENREC does have on their website a model that they prepared, and the guidance document does recommend using this model, the DERM, Delaware Urban Runoff Management Model. And when I talked about having that 74-acre development, I looked at the soils developed, basically taking out all the hydric soils, leaving me with the hydrologic soil group A and B soils that are on the site, and said, what are we going to do if we have a quarter-acre lot or the whole thing as cluster housing, using the recommendations for the townhouse development, and there's actually a typo on that screen. It's not 645%, but it's only 65% impervious. Anyway, what kind of capacity that you have for the site is you're going to have to be able to have, in the case of quarter-acre townhouse lots, approximately 94,000 cubic feet of infiltration capacity, of water being able to infiltrate into the soils or other ways addressed by best management practices. And given the condition of the site and where we are with the groundwater table, I don't know whether that's going to be feasible. Same with the townhouse development. You're going to end up having my guess is around 193,000 cubic yards of infiltration capacity needed. And that could be done with infiltration basin capacity, where you get one-on-one for a bioretention and underdrainage. You don't get full credit for that capacity, but it does count towards your total, as well as infiltration trenches and permeable pavement. And I assume that probably one thing you may want to consider, especially recommending, is using permeable pavement and infiltration trenches in your roadways, especially if you're having roadways across the hydric soils, because, again, one of my main emphases is really just protecting the function of the hydric soils, not so much just dealing with the engineering controls, but, again, the function of them and how they interact with the controlling of the water. So, again, in summary, I believe that the site's potential is limited by the environmental constraints, and right now, in the present form, the application should be rejected or at least sent back for additional consideration, as well as making sure that, frankly, since you're probably not going to be able to get this final development plan approved from the Conservation District by July 1st, now's the time to say come back with a plan that meets the stormwater regulations, including doing that work. And while Mr. Hines went out and did some studies, one of the things that's going to have to be done is doing a site-specific study for infiltration, so you could really figure out whether or not you have sufficient capacity for infiltration at the site to support the development that's just finally going to be put together. And that is my end of my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the was there another speaker that was lined up? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Barsar.
And if you'll give us your name and address for the record, please. I see you're signing in. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable council members and staff, thank you for allowing me to speak this afternoon. My name is Richard Morganti. I am the president of the Old Landing Woods Homeowners Association.
Richard, could you spell your last name for us, please?
Sure. Morgante.
Thank you.
I am speaking on behalf of the Homeowners Association with the approval of the Board of Directors. While our owners recognize the right of the owner of the golf course, to request rezoning of that property. We're asking, as others have and will this afternoon, that you closely scrutinize this request. As our testimony will show, we believe there are some serious questions and serious flaws with the proposal. And just to show you graphically where our homeowners association is, it's roughly where that red outline is. It consists of two roads, Fairway Drive and Clubhouse Drive, that Mr. Fuqua pointed out. And if you look, if you're over on that side on the site map, it's the pink. That's Fairway Drive, and that is Clubhouse Drive. So our association and our homeowners association and our owners surround a good portion of this property that's the subject of this rezoning request. The Old Landing Woods Owners Association is a quaint development. We have 41 large lots. It was established in the late 1970s. It surrounds, as you saw, a good portion of the Old Landing Golf Course, and we're on those two private roads, as I said, Fairway Drive and Clubhouse Drive. We're a very tranquil development, and we feel seriously threatened by the current proposal for Osprey Point. We feel it has an uncertain impact on the value of our homes and our peaceful neighborhoods, and I'll elaborate on that as we go along. As I said, we have large lots, single-family homes, each unique in character, all custom-built, started in the late 1970s. The adjacent golf course is zoned AR1, and when we bought our homes, we understood AR1 is currently the zoning for the golf course, but that could be rezoned or developed, not rezoned, but could be developed as single-family homes under that current AR1 zoning. Increasing the density by rezoning to an MR-RPC, we feel is out of character with our neighborhood. We're not a rural area. We're not a farmland. We're an established community. Zoning makes a neighborhood what it is. And we believe the AR1 zoning for this property is reasonable and should not be changed. I'll speak to our concerns of our homeowners. First, our environmental and flooding concerns, placing homes in the flood zone, and the stormwater management. Second are the lots along Fairway Drive, which I understand from Mr. Fuqua's presentation have been removed. Third, density. Fourth is traffic, which you've heard about. And finally, road ownership. Let me talk about environmental and flooding concerns. The land, as Ms. Lediger mentioned, is in an environmentally sensitive development area adjacent to Arnell Creek and Rehoboth Bay. It's replete with critical habitat. When you look at the FEMA maps for this property, and that's what we did. When you look at the FEMA maps for the property, according to FEMA, they have a tool online, and you can map out what the property is. These areas are labeled AE1, and those are flood areas. And 58%, according to the FEMA's flood map, is 58% of this property is in an AE1 flood zone. Particularly, one of the areas within that horseshoe, which is made up of Fairway Drive and Clubhouse Drive, that particular area is prone to flooding, and I intend to show you that. We think the proposal that they've made for Osprey Point is contrary to the Sussex County Code, as others have pointed out in particular, because it talks about the minimal use of wetlands and floodplains. And we have seen nothing in terms of special studies, investigations, or technical data to show that this particular development can overcome these flooding issues. And that has caused us a great deal of concern. The Old Landing Woods homes are on well water. You've already heard that. When we read the PLUS report, it noted that adding these impervious surfaces to this area will adversely impact both the quantity and the quality of the water. We depend on wells for our drinking water. We have seen no study, irrigation, or technical data on this particular issue, and we're concerned. What happens when this development is approved and these houses are built and problems arise? We either are going to have to dig our wells from the 70-foot aquifer to 150-foot, or we're going to have to pay to get tidewater to run lines into that development and connect to tidewater. Donna Voigt from our team brought this issue up to Denbrock, and he simply said that we could just get tidewater. Well, what about the fundamental fairness in that? Why should our homeowners have to bear the expense of running water into our neighborhoods and paying for those connections because of somebody else's development? So we're very concerned about that. And we think further investigation is needed on that point to make sure, to assure our homeowners that our well water won't be impacted. And I heard at the planning and zoning hearing that Rehoboth Bay community also uses well water, and somebody spoke at planning and zoning. They're also concerned about this very same issue because they use well water. And in fact, I hope that individual's here because he very articulately and with some data explained that far better than I can explain it.
Mr. Morgante, if I may, Mr. President.
Sure.
I find it intriguing that somebody from Denrick says basically the heck with the quality of the water, just use public water. Mm-hmm. Is that what I've just heard?
That is what you just heard. And that it was actually my reaction as well. And Donna Voigt is the individual that spoke to Denrock on this.
I mean, it's not insinuating good water or bad water, but I just find that intriguing that somebody from Denrock would make a statement like that. But okay, I just wanted to reconfirm that I heard that right.
For that project, isn't that, yeah.
Oh, for that
specifically
project.
I understand that.
On this particular issue, I'm not sure if they were speaking in general.
Okay, thank you.
As I said, 58% of this land is in the AE1 flood zone. It is prone to flooding. Even modest rainfalls cause severe flooding on the golf course property. Where is that water going to go? That is our concern. Where's that water going to go? And the pictures that I'm going to show you, I think, will demonstrate why we have these concerns. This is just a picture of the golf course at a normal summer day. I took this picture several years ago, and that's one of the retention ponds. This picture was taken December 9th. Ordinary rainfall. I'm sure none of you even remember December 9th and the rainfall we had on December 9th because it was an ordinary rain. This is along Fairway Drive where those blue tabs are there. This is right along Fairway Drive. And the trees along Fairway Drive. This one was taken about a week and a half ago after a rainstorm. And look at the flooding that's in that area. Moderate rainfall. The particular area at the end of that horseshoe, which is right there with the green tabs, this causes us particular concern. This was December 9th again. Looking out of the front porch of a house on Fairway Drive across to the golf course, you can see that flooding extends completely across the golf course from Fairway over to Clubhouse Drive. Just a closer view. This is from a house on Clubhouse Drive, their backyard, facing right here. This house right here facing out toward the golf course, just showing this water running completely across that area. This is from the golf course looking down the golf cart path toward the house where they took the picture. And this was taken actually in October after another rainstorm from a homeowner on Fairway Drive. But ordinary rainfalls completely flooded from Clubhouse Drive all the way over to Fairway Drive. And I'd like to just add here some pictures that we took of Sandy rainfall. And I know some of you will say, well, Sandy was, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime storm. Well, I would like to just ask you to stop and consider this. In 2012, we had Sandy, and we had a bad storm. But in 2011, we had Hurricane Irene, and we stayed here during that hurricane. And let me tell you, it was as bad as Sandy. In 2008, Tropical Storm Hannah. In 2006, Tropical Storm Ernesto, flooding on the golf course. 2003, Isabel. These storms are not happening once in a lifetime. These storms are happening every couple of years. And that is why we're concerned. And I know Ms. Lediger handed out to you the news journal. And this was in Sunday's paper, the headline, Sandy was a warning. I'd just like to read two pieces of this to you. A new Army Corps of Engineers report warns that unless coastal residents and state and local leaders rethink their approach to shoreline development, the next big storm will be equal to or worse than Superstorm Sandy. Further on, among the key findings, flood risk is already increasing. Better land use planning is needed, especially in flood-prone areas, and the use of natural and nature-based approaches should be used to minimize or reduce flood risk when development can't be avoided. So I want to show you some of these pictures because what happened in Sandy is going to happen again, and we're concerned about that. This is off the deck of a house from Fairway Drive that actually abuts the golf course. This is actually coming out of his lower level. This is a house next door looking out during that sandy flooding, and you can see the more extensive flooding during that sandy storm. This is taken from a house next door. Again, great flooding in that area. And then toward the end of Clubhouse Drive, which is the little orange markers there. These pictures were taken by the homeowner living at the end of Fairway Drive. The top shows that area on October 14th, a normal day. December 9th, rainstorm that many of you, I'm sure most of you or none of us remember. And look at how far that water exceeded that waterway. Just another angle further looking closer to the golf course there. And this is the end of Clubhouse Drive. On the top, Clubhouse Drive, October 14th. On the bottom, Clubhouse Drive completely flooded over on December 9th. Again, a normal rain. And this is a shot from the golf course of the little waterway that runs across that area. Again, it's where those orange tabs are there. I want to talk about Arnell Creek. And these were taken during Sandy. But again, these are our homeowners. And the reason I want to do that, if I could just put that up. If I could just show you what our concerns are, because it's reality for us. Mm-hmm. When the storms come up the coast, they push that water through the Indian River Inlet, as you know, all the trouble that we had with the Indian River Bridge there, into Rehoboth Bay, and that water pushes all the way up Rehoboth Bay into Arnell Creek and pushes that water through these two natural waterways onto the golf course. And so that water is, during these storms, pushes up here, up the creek. This is Arnell Creek. Our homeowners have homes along this area here, and it pushes it onto the golf course. And so what I'd like to do is just show you, during Sandy, some of the flooding that they experienced. Because again, this land is going to be developed. We're going to be putting roads there. We're going to be putting houses there. And where is this water going to go? That's the question I ask. This is off the back deck of a house at 22 Clubhouse Drive. And you can see where there are little benches that they sit out watching the water go down Arnell Creek. You can see where that bench is and where their dock runs out, and that is marshland. In normal times, all that area is grassy water. That water came up under the deck and into that lower level of that house. This was a house two doors down the day afterwards, after the water started receding, but you can see what it did to the tree there as well as that decking. This was a house next door, taken during the storm, the water all the way up the backyard and onto the driveway. And the house next door, this is their backyard, completely flooded. These were taken, as I said, during Sandy. But these are the reasons that we're so concerned about this development. Where is the stormwater going to go? And I'd like to put up a couple photographs. It's not just our community that has problems. There are two roads at the end of Old Landing that abut the other side of the property, and I'm hoping that those folks will speak as well. Arnell Road and Marshall Road. This is flooding during Sandy on Marshall Road.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's high tide.
Oh, I'm sorry, high tide.
That is high tide, yeah.
That is high. I stand corrected. And that's high tide on Marshall Road. They abut the property on the other end, Arnell Road and Marshall Road, and I'm sure that some of you know those roads well. Mm-hmm. We're concerned. I know I've spoken to owners on Arnell Road. I've spoken to owners on Marshall Road, and I hope some of them will speak today because they're at this end of the property, if you want to point out, at that end of the property. And they're going to experience the same problems, and they have the same concerns that we have. So our issue are these lots in the flood-prone area. I thank Mr. Fakwa and Mr. Marshall for removing two lots from that area. But two lots is not the area that floods. By our estimation, and this is from just looking where this water is and overlaying it, there are at least eight lots in that flood area. And I appreciate them removing two, but we believe there are more lots that need to be removed from that flood zone there. I think those lots will be problematic, not only for our homeowners, but also the new homeowners. If you build a house there, that is a floodplain. Where is it going to go? Into Old Landing Woods? Into Arnell Road? Into Marshall Road? Where is it going to go? I spoke to DENREC, to the stormwater management. I spoke to James Elliott, who's a deputy program manager. And I asked him about this Osprey Point stormwater management plan. I wanted to understand, why did you grandfather them in? And what does this mean for us? And he explained, and some of this was already repeated, but he said, listen, anybody who came in, any developer who came in and asked to be grandfathered, we just grandfathered them. And I said, why? He said, well, because they asked. I said, well, will you explain to me in layman's terms, because I'm not an engineer, what does that mean? And he said, well, if they get their stormwater management plan approved by July 1st, 2015, they will be covered under the old regs. And in layman's terms, it means under the old regs, they have to come up to a plan. They are given a quantity waiver. They have to lay out a plan. What they don't have to do, which is under the new reg, is show how that water and make arrangements to contain that water. To me, that's a big difference. A plan showing how you're going to contain that water developed by engineers would sure give me and the homeowners within the Old Landing Woods Owners Association a lot more comfort that the water's going to be controlled. I hear Mr. Crouch, as he said at the planning and zoning today, you know, that these will be dealt with. Mr. Fakwa on the phone told me, you know, we'll do a stormwater management plan, and I appreciate that. But that's really saying to us, trust us. And I say, where's the beef? So that's my only. So as you know, we're very concerned about stormwater management. The issue on Fairway Drive, was placing 12 homes along Fairway Drive. They have removed those from the site plan. And I thank Mr. Marshall and Mr. Farquhar for contacting us and telling us they were going to remove that. We did not have the availability of the new site plan to review it, so I left that in there, not knowing whether that plan would be here today. And so those were our concerns, and they have eliminated those 12 lots, and we thank them for that. But it brings up another issue, which is the road ownership. I'm sure Mr. Marshall put those houses along Fairway Drive because he owns Fairway Drive. He owns Fairway Drive and Clubhouse Drive. When our development was developed and those lots were sold, the roads were never turned over to the Old Landing Woods Owners Association. Mr. Steve Simmons, who was the president for 25 years, explained to me that Mr. Marshall's father and then Mr. Marshall did not turn those roads over because they ran the golf course. And they wanted access to their golf course without going through, you know, a homeowners association. And I can understand that. But if we're now rezoning that land for development, don't you think it's time that those roads get turned over to the association? We have paved those roads and we have maintained those roads since our association has been there. And I believe it's time that those be turned over to the association. No taxes paid on those roads. We pave them, we have paved them, we maintain them. And I'm asking the council, as part of this request, to now turn those roads over to the Old Landing Woods Owners Association. I think it was Mr. Arlette, you asked the question, I believe it was, about the roads. Are those going to be turned over to the new association? And they said, certainly. And I think it's time now. 1978, this was developed. I think it's time for the roads to be turned over to the Old Landing Woods Owners Association. I'm going to talk about density because I'm going to talk about density a little differently than Mr. Fuqua did. The original Osprey Point plan was for 2.77. It's been reduced to 2.6 as of today's site plan. And the applicant asserts that it's aligned with and less than nearby communities. Well, let me just talk about our community, Old Landing Woods Development. We're at 1.57 per acre. 1.57. We have no common areas. All the land is developed and is owned by our homeowners. 1.57. The woods in Arnell Creek, which, Ed, if you could just point out where that will be, the council just a little over a year ago approved a development called the Woods at Arnell Creek at the end of Fairway Drive. That is at 1.72 houses per acre, approved by this council. Sawgrass North, to a layman, and I understand, Mr. Fuqua, what your calculations were, but when I look at Sawgrass, and I came down here in Mr. Lank's office and pulled those files for Sawgrass, they're at 2 per acre. And I understand, and he's explained, yeah, but some of that is wetland. But that's across the road, and that's 2 per acre. And I see that there's wetlands there, but it's 2 per acre. We're 1.57. Woods at Arnell Creek, 1.72. I found out last night, looking through the records here for the planning and zoning, Arnell Creek, which is just up the road, I'm sure Mrs. Deaver knows where that is, 2 per acre. And so if you talk about alignment with existing developments, I think you can make an argument, just as strong an argument as Mr. Fuqua made about others are denser. I think we can make an argument that lower density is aligned with the other communities. And the issue of traffic, I will not belabor this point. You've already heard from DelDOT. You've raised your own questions. I would just say we agree with you. The time for action is now. And let me just show another picture, because a picture sometimes speaks a thousand words. January 23rd, there was a one-car accident on Old Landing Road. Some of you may remember it. Mm-hmm. Car flipped over. A woman was pinned in the car. Old Landing Road was shut down for 2 hours. No one in, no one out. This picture was taken from Fairway Drive looking toward Old Landing Roads. The cars lined up to get out of our development. 2 hours, in excess of 2 hours, no one could move in or out of our development. So I think you recognize that by your very questions. These are real issues. And let me just flip to our request then. It's simply this. Leave the zoning as is. AR1 is reasonable with respect to this land. Eliminate lots in flood-prone areas. They've already eliminated the lots on Fairway Drive, and I thank them for that. Demand storm management information before approving a site plan. Reduce the density to keep it in character with the surrounding developments. Demand some traffic study and some action on that. And finally, to turn the roads over to the Old Landing Woods Owners Association. I think this is a question of fundamental fairness for our owners. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
I do have one question, Mr. President. May I?
Certainly.
Mr. Morgante, your community, Old Landing Woods, of the, is it 41 home sites?
Yes.
How many are all of them in a flood zone?
Not all of ours are in a flood zone.
Do you have a percent? Do you have any? I'm only curious because those photos depict an issue. So I'm just curious as it relates to your community, flood zone or not. I know you share concerns with this new community, potential new community, but I'm curious as it relates to your own specific community next door.
I think it's all a flood zone or just different categories. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. It's all a flood zone.
Everything's a flood. Yes.
Right.
It's all a flood zone. It's just what level.
The mic's right there.
What level. And I can tell you, so these are AE1. Right. So those flood. This area here, because my house is right here, this is a zone X. So if you own a house here and have a mortgage, you aren't required to have flood insurance.
High ground.
This is higher ground. So this is higher ground. This, all of this is AE1. This is Clubhouse Drive. All of the homes in Old Landing Woods that are on that side of the road are in an AE1 flood area. Those were the flood pictures that I was showing you during Sandy. There's one lot here that's in a flood zone. These lots, which is includes, there's four lots here, are not. And then when you get down here, these are in a different category. I don't know the particular one. But this home is not. These homes are not. And none of those homes aren't. This is actually a little waterway that runs here. There's nothing built, even though somebody owns that land.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, was there another organized speaker coming after you?
Yes, and I'd like to introduce Donna Voigt, who will speak to traffic.
Okay, we've also heard a lot concerning traffic, so I would just ask that try to have
a Reader's
your
Digest version.
Okay. I'll try to do that for you.
Yes. Remember when I first made the presentation, please do not repeat points raised by others.
True. Okay, I'll try to keep it brief then. I'm Donna Voigt. I'm a resident of Sawgrass South. I live at 21058 Laguna Drive, and I actually have a picture of my house that I'll show you. I'm speaking on behalf of a large group of residents today that are opposing this rezoning, and the particular issues are going to be in life safety and traffic, and I know we've talked a lot about traffic, so we won't belabor that. So the two things that I do want to talk about are the increased traffic without any planned relief, and I will be brief on that because Mr. Arlette and Mr. Cole and Ms. Deaver, you guys have done a really good job today, and we appreciate that, recognizing that as an issue for us. And then the insufficient considerations of life safety impacts, that's something that we haven't heard about today, but we are going to talk about it. So just in way of introduction, my background is in systems and software engineering, and I tell you that because I'm not an attorney. But I thought that might give you a little relief. However, I have spent many years in executive leadership positions where I was often faced with many complex and difficult decisions that significantly impacted employees, customers, and business. So I personally understand the challenges and difficulties that you guys face with making impactful decisions that have lasting consequences, such as face this council regarding land use. If you look at my little chart here, the council really has to do a careful job of balancing the desire to increase the revenue base while also trying to ensure the adherence to county ordinances, state and federal law, and the health, safety, and welfare of the existing Sussex County inhabitants. The laws and ordinances were written with built-in discretion and judgment to be levied by the Sussex County Council. It's simply not a rubber stamp process, yet one that seeks compliance with formalized rules with strict guidance requiring the council to consider the impact of an application upon the existing situation and circumstances as we find it today. This is truly a balancing act. The Sussex County mobility element of the comprehensive plan from June 2008 addresses the intergovernmental issues, stating appropriate transportation facilities and sound transportation investments will not happen without ongoing coordination and cooperation between different levels of government. And we heard that some today and appreciate DLDOT coming down today on that. So this is actually part of your comprehensive plan in the mobility element, and it seeks to have coordination and cooperation between the local level as well as the state level. And I'd also direct your attention to Sussex County Code 115-3, which directs the council to promote, in accordance with the present and future needs, the health, safety, and general welfare of the inhabitants of Sussex County, Delaware, among other things, the lessening of congestion in the streets or roads, and securing safety from fire, flood, and other dangers. The last piece that I would like to point out is from 2010, Delaware Strategies for State Policies and Spending. In their executive summary, they state, the purpose of this, the policy and spending document, is to coordinate land use decision-making with the provision of infrastructure and services in a manner that makes the best use of our natural and fiscal resources. The importance of such coordination lies in the fact that land use decisions are made at the local level, while the bulk of infrastructure, the roads, schools, and services, such as emergency services and social services that support land use decisions, are funded by the state. So I'd also like to mention that I do have an email that we've included in our notebook from Pete Schwarzkopf discussing his views on this proposed application and his meeting that he was having with he and Senator Lopez to meet with LDOT to talk about Old Landing Road improvements. And in his letter, he states, in my opinion, the number of houses already permissible will exacerbate the traffic conditions there, let alone if they grant this increase in density. I don't think it's in the community's best interest to allow any rezoning request that would increase the housing density until there is a transportation plan in place. Let's face it, it's a lot easier to put in corrective action before you build out than try to go back and retroactively address the problem. And this is the last piece.
Ms. Boyd, I apologize. Just to clarify, that was from Representative Schwarzkopf, is that correct?
Schwarzkopf, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you remind him that he ought to do his part with DLDOT?
Well, that's why we've reached out to him.
I just posed that question. So we'll do the land use. He can take care of the roads.
Yeah, I mean, it's honest to God, it's a balancing act. And so really our viewpoint is, after having many conversations, is that we've kind of gotten out of balance, that and we feel like it's time to rebalance. There was a lot of development that was approved, a lot of rezoning applications that went through, and it's simply time to rebalance, that this is a little two-lane, two-and-a-half-mile dead-end road. It's a rural road, and it's dark at night, and we have a whole lot of accidents that happen along that road, and I'm going to talk a lot about that in a little bit. And basically, fundamentally, the residents that live on this road have one way in and one way out. So unfortunately, despite years of analysis and discussion regarding the needed improvements for Old Landing Road, improvements have not been made, and more development was approved with a promise of remediation.
Simply stated, the rampant approval of rezoning and development, coupled with DLDOT's failure to address the traffic and life safety issues, has significantly impacted the health, safety, general welfare of those living in communities along Old Landing Road. In other words, there appears to be a lack of coordination and cooperation between county land use decisions along Old Landing Road and state policies and spending to lessen the congestion along Old Landing Road, securing residents' safety from fire, flood, and other dangers. It's simply time to rebalance the scales, and let's get the right infrastructure in place.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, first of all, I did want to, I'm not going to belabor this a whole lot, but I did want to talk about the traffic. This, as you guys know, this has gone on for years and years and years, at least from 1996. It's been a quiet, I'm sure you've had a parade of people in here talking about traffic along Old Landing Road over the years. DLDOT did not require a TIS like they stated earlier. And there, frankly, is no transportation plan for Old Landing Road. The chart at the bottom is simply the numbers that show you how well that this new development meets the criteria set by DLDOT to require an impact study, yet none was done. They meet it by nearly 7.3 times higher than the vehicle trip ends per day, 5.6 times higher for the number of vehicle trips per hour. So clearly it was warranted, but it didn't happen for a lot of the reasons that we heard today. So in 2003, DLDOT indicated that additional traffic from Sawgrass South, which was then called Warrington Creek, would negatively impact the level of service at Old Landing Road and Warrington Road and Old Landing Road and Airport Road. Now, that was 2003. So in 2011, they did a TIS, a traffic impact study, and they concluded that Warrington Road was operating at a level of service F, which means the demand exceeds its designed capacity.
Can you go any lower?
No, you can't. So, you know, when you just step back a minute and you think about it, adding 340, 350 more homes doesn't improve the situation. It just makes it worse. So DLDOT outlined some reparative measures in the 2011 study, but again, they failed to deliver. So it's something that can be fixed, but it's something that has not been fixed in many, many years. DLDOT's TIS criteria, this is another thing that's just a little bit of a burn. DLDOT's TIS criteria that no deaths have occurred is not comforting. They looked at they looked at the crash data, and they made a judgment that, well, you know, we haven't had any deaths. So it's just not very comforting to those of us that live on that little two-lane narrow road. And it also, we do not believe that should be the litmus test for whether or not you do a traffic impact study. Furthermore, limited remediation alternatives were considered and none that considered the entire length of the road. They looked at the choke points. They looked at the intersections, and you heard DLDOT talk about that today. You're looking out at the intersection, then going three intersections out from there. It's not looking at the length of the road, and there are significantly large problems along that roadway. Two-lane roads, 2.5 miles, one way in, one way out in an evacuation zone. So they didn't require a TIS, but they accepted the developer's proposal, as you heard earlier today, to create a traffic operational analysis, for which the developer conducted and paid for. And when you look through the TOA, because it's some light reading, you've got both volumes now, you'll notice that the stated reason for the TOA was to save DLDOT money that would be required to review a TIS, and also generate $24,500 in revenue for the state. That's right out of the TOA. So it appears that it's not that the TIS was not warranted, but rather DLDOT would rather collect some money and claim they have sufficient information about Old Landing Road traffic, and simply no further traffic study is necessary.
The 24.5, you're referring to contributions coming in from developers?
Yes, that was coming in from Osprey.
All right.
So
all right.
Osprey does the TOA, and they contribute $24,000.
Sure, I can't remember. Did they have it or don't have it?
Yes. Of our discussions, or your discussions now, discussing the TIS, TOA, we don't have jurisdiction over that.
Understood. Yeah.
We're not the ones that requested it. So if you could move on and get to some of your other points, please. Mm-hmm.
I think we would all agree that DLDOT has to get shaken up a little bit. I would have a feeling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this was just added to their traffic report, and we're challenging the validity and integrity of data that was used in the TIS mm-hmm. when you're counting data during the middle of a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. This we talked about some today, too. Where's the money? Mm-hmm. I had a phone call with Bill Brockenbrell and asked him, and you know, in some cases, these builders have gone belly up, and it's like, well, how do you collect when a builder went belly up? And he agreed, it's a collection problem. So we'll skip on to life safety, because this is something we haven't had a good discussion on. So we find ourselves with a rural road operating at a level F with no commitment from DLDOT to remedy. Perhaps worse is a failure to accurately consider the life safety issues along Old Landing Road and the increased risk the zoning request poses to residents. It's not simply measuring traffic volumes and queue lengths, but also understanding that the impact, what happens when an emergency condition occurs and what the impact is to the residents. So a couple of the key things I wanted to talk about is, again, we have one way in, one way out, and nobody looked at what's the impact when an emergency response is needed. This is an evacuation zone. How do people get out when you need to get out and you have this little two-lane road and you just keep adding more and more residents? And then the increased risk to pedestrians and bicyclists has really been minimally required. We have little stretches where you'll have a pedestrian and bicycle.
Somewhere, don't you? You have a couple bike lanes, or does it go all the way down?
They don't go all the way down. The shoulder's 4 foot wide in some places. In some places, it's not even 4 foot wide. Mm-hmm. If you choose to walk or bicycle there, you're taking your life in your hands. They'll literally, a car will brush by you. I don't do it anymore, personally. So I told you I was going to show you my house. That's my house in the top. You can barely see it. You can see the outline up here and sort of a house back there behind the fence. This was a couple of weeks ago, January 23rd, 2015, where a driver... Now, my house is right... I back to Old Landing Road. The golf course is directly across the street. You can see this is Sawgrass South. Driver lost control, went through the fence, goes back onto the road, loses control again, only to crash through the fence again and end up in the woods. Flipped. From October, this is data comes from DLDOT. It's a crash analysis report system. There were 18 reported crashes during this period. 7 of these crashes were on or adjacent to Osprey Point site between the Bonair and Mirabella entrances. 4 of these accidents occurred in 2014 and 1 already in 2015. So I know that as all of you know, are very much aware, it's really important when you have an emergency condition that first responders are able to get to the scene. That's really that's life or death. If you can't get there, if you have one accident on that road and it's impassable, and like we heard earlier, we had a just recent incident where 2 hours people couldn't get in or out. Imagine if somebody has a heart attack. You already have another issue going on. You're not going to be able to respond. Is that fair? Is that protecting the life and safety of existing residents? I don't think so. And I think that's a significant concern. And it's the same thing if it's a weather event. We are in an evacuation zone. How do you get that many people down a little two-lane road and let them evacuate safely? Basically, at the end of the day, people die is what happens. They die and you have property damage and it's needless. One other thing I wanted to mention, 39% of the accidents, when you look at that data, 39% of those accidents occurred along the golf course frontage. 40% of those accidents happened between 6 and 8 p.m. I back to that trail, that little walking path, bicycle trail. I will tell you that's peak utilization of that path. That's when people are walking with their kids, bicycling, walking the dog. That's peak time. It's a matter of time before an errant driver runs over somebody there. So again, adding more salt to the soup isn't necessarily a good fix. The other thing I wanted to note, and again, this is about life safety, the Delaware State Police Strategic Plan for 2014 through 18 noted traffic safety as one of their key concerns, and they're concerned about their ability to provide adequate services. During this period, they're expecting to have another 16,000 residents move into Sussex County. They simply are worried that they're not going to have enough force to protect the inhabitants. So Osprey development with a density of 350 homes will add approximately 1,300 additional residents and would mean increased pedestrian bicycle traffic as well as more cars and trucks involving over 2,900 trips per day on this rural road, again with one way in and one way out. It's also going to increase traffic and related safety issues, for which the Delaware State Police Troop No. 7 will not be able to deliver quantity and competent law enforcement service due to their already low staffing levels, and this will undoubtedly jeopardize our public safety. It's another indication of where we really need to see the county and the state work together to resolve these problems. This is a narrow and winding two-lane road. It's not lit at night, and it does not have a continuous sidewalk or standard shoulder. Residents are already afraid to bicycle or walk along this road, and really you can't blame them. If you drive down the road, it's pretty clear why. So in summary, you know, what we're really asking for, and you've heard this a lot today, we're not trying to deny somebody their right to develop their land or saying that they shouldn't, but what we're asking for is do things in a prudent manner. There are some significant concerns with not only the manner in which this is being proposed to be developed, but also significant life safety issues here. And we urge you to please work with the state. Let the applicant go back to the drawing board, rework their plans, give the state an opportunity to create a transportation plan, and let's do the right thing for the citizens. So we respectfully request that the Osprey Point rezoning application be denied and reevaluated after the traffic and life safety issues have been addressed and a transportation plan for Old Landing Road is developed, approved, and funded, and that the council limit the Osprey Point density to ensure alignment with the Old Landing Road improvements. Let's get back in balance and get back in sync. And to that end, again, it's all of our home, our environment, and our future, and we're asking that you protect it. Thank you.
Is there another organized speaker that
thank you, Mrs.
lined up? Or?
Bill Close.
If I may approach, just a couple of conclusory remarks.
No, okay.
Ms. Fever, you had a
question.
I was
going to ask Mr. Lang, Fire Marshal. He's already signed off on this, hasn't he?
No.
What?
No.
No, okay. At what point will we hear from Fire Marshal?
If the rezoning gets approved, then the applicants get into the process of submitting the preliminary approval or for preliminary approval through the commission with the required condition of approval imposed by council.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go to all the agencies and obtain approvals before we look at it as a final. We won't look at it again as a
and
final until we get all the approvals.
You consider that one of the agencies?
All agency approvals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
And if I may, I just have a couple of conclusory remarks. Applicant makes much of the fact that other developments have been developed on similar soils and environs. However, those developments, many of those developments, were constructed under old regulations and old science. We have new regulations and a new comprehensive plan. Query whether those developments would have passed the special scrutiny now required. Just because it was done before doesn't mean it's prudent now. We maintain that as currently proposed, it is not prudent or permissible now. Secondly, we do not remotely consider this a popularity contest. Hopefully, council recognizes that we have not addressed this as a popularity contest. We have provided council genuine concerns with regard to density environmental, flooding, and traffic concerns. And we ask that those be given serious consideration. This is not a case of wanting to prevent an applicant from all development. But if development is to proceed, to have the development proceed sensibly, and we ask that you ensure that it proceed that way. I would also like to present counsel, as did Mr. Fuqua, with proposed findings and conditions, if I may approach.
Yes.
That's good.
Thank you.
As a last item, we request counsel defer a decision on this matter and keep the record open based on new information that has been provided counsel. And I would just remind counsel that these are the people that I represent who have presented, and I'm not sure if there are others. Thank you for your time and effort.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to speak?
Please.
Yes, first I would remind you we've heard substantial amount of testimony.
I understand.